Welcome to Not Enough Champagne, a podcast embracing the inner Boudica. My name's Corey Hazelhurst and my partner in propaganda is Steve Haynes.
Hey Corey.
Now this episode is all about Brexit, and our doomed Prime Minister Theresa May has been told to compare herself to various ancient political figures. Now, our old friend Nick Timothy, a columnist without self-awareness or shame, he wrote this week that, and I quote, "The Prime Minister needs to find her inner Boudica and say, 'On your way, Barnier.'" Because, of course, Steve, any political message is more powerful if it rhymes.
And, of course, Boudica, well known for her poetry.
I think it's quite an unfortunate comparison because Boudica's army literally destroyed towns and killed thousands of Britons who it thought were traitors for surrendering to a European power.
It's almost like an apt metaphor for Brexit, isn't it?
And then, of course, met her match against a more disciplined opponent.
Stop, this is just getting far too real.
Disturbingly, it's not the only ancient history reference this week, because European Council President and hard man Donald Tusk, he said that the Brexit talks were becoming like the Gordian knot, and that unfortunately, I can't see a new version of Alexander the Great. It's not that easy to find that sort of creative leader. I mean, if there was a great prodigy out there, Steve, it's probably not Johnny Mercer, who this week said that the government's a complete shit show and he wouldn't vote for the Conservatives if it weren't for the fact that he's a Conservative MP.
Pretty damning, really, isn't it?
It makes Chris Leslie look like an ultra-loyalist, which is impressive. But that was in an interview with a House magazine, and last month's House magazine scoop was when Karen Bradley basically said she didn't understand her job. So, memo to the government communications department:
don't let anybody talk to the House magazine. Anytime they do, you're just creating problems for yourself.
Which ancient politician do you think would be best to handle Brexit, Steve?
I'm thinking we should just go for the very direct route and get Hannibal to just run some elephants over the entirety of the Brexit negotiations of both sides. Just cancel it all.
Would we have to do customs checks on those elephants?
Probably.
I'm imagining kind of lorries full of elephants backing up to Dover.
Going over some mountains on the way.
Hmm. I think that it would probably be Augustus. He seems like a pretty canny political figure. More specifically, I think the Augustus played by Brian Blessed and I, Claudius, would have Brexit down to a T. All of this is basically a very lengthy way of saying Brexit's a mess. We're going to try and look a little bit at the details, and we're going to have a look at the main reason for May's plight, which is, if we're honest, probably her terrible communication skills. Every month or couple of months now, for about 2 years, we've essentially put out a version of the same podcast. And that podcast has basically said there isn't enough time to do a proper deal. Theresa May isn't really being honest about the trade-offs that need to happen. The Tory party has got no idea of what it wants or any kind of concept of reality. And the EU's position hasn't really changed. And usually we've included something about the Irish border.
Yeah, I mean, to quote Theresa May during the 2017 general election, nothing has changed. Nothing has changed. And that's the problem. Nothing has shifted. Nothing has progressed in any form. And in areas where, you know, progress was made, like, you know, guarantees that Britain would honour an Irish backstop in some form, well, suddenly the Brexiteers and the Tory party have realised that, the backstop means that we might actually have to stay in the customs union because we can't separate Northern Ireland out from the rest of the UK because of the DUP, which they should have been listening to our podcast because we realise that, and yet these highly educated Oxbridge graduates haven't twigged that at all and seemingly are now saying they were duped by the government. It beggars belief. It really does.
Does anything David Davis does really beggar your belief?
No, everything that David Davis does seem to kind of meet my expectation of what David Davis would do. I mean, there was a wonderful little thing which was been briefed, I think, today to some of the newspapers, where it's bigging up David Davis's chances as a kind of an interim leader to take Britain through the Brexit negotiations. One of the reasons given for this was that Labour MPs have a lot of respect for David Davis. It's like, which Labour MPs? There's only one Kate Hoey, who's about the only one I could think of, really, that would actually go, yes, this is a fine, fine man.
And we're not going to speculate on Conservative leadership rumours, because we did that in our silly season episode, but also because we want to try and conserve our tears. But there is apparently, as you say, a rumour that David Davis will be put up as some sort of caretaker Prime Minister, which is hilarious, if only because the job I think David Davis is least suited for is a caretaker. David Davis is not a details man. There is no way that a organisation with David Davis as a caretaker would get its corridors cleaned efficiently. And I have a feeling because of his lack of details, there'll be some sort of problem with the plumbing system, which would mean the whole building would be filled with sewage.
It's another apt metaphor for Brexit, really, isn't it?
Well, indeed. So since December, when this Irish wicketkeeper plan was put together, which we'll talk about in a second, we've had two big Brexit events that basically came and went without us being able to talk about them. One of them was the Chequers plan, when May got the cabinet together and the cabinet were united on a plan for about 30 minutes.
And then people left, realised that they didn't actually like it, and then started complaining about it.
I think Boris Johnson resigned to try and spend more time with his career. There was also a summit about a month or two ago at Salzburg, and Theresa May was, I think, hoping that the Chequers plan would be kept on the road until Salzburg, and the EU leader said, this is not going to happen.
Yeah, the EU basically turned around, looked at the Chequers plan, and like anybody else who's got any knowledge of how the single market works, went, no, this will not do. You cannot cherry pick membership of the single market. This is a fine starting point, but there must be further concessions for us to make this work. And of course, May had already gone into there saying, this is our final offer. Which was just dumb in so many ways. The classic problem that so much of the Brexiteer class in Parliament, and to a degree the right-wing press as well, have, they forget that just because we don't speak German or French and we can't read their papers particularly well or regularly, doesn't mean that they aren't reading ours. And they seem to have forgotten that. So you had this odd situation where you've got people like Theresa May, Jeremy Hunt, and to a degree before he buggered off to the back benches, Boris Johnson, saying one thing in meetings and then coming back and briefing something completely different to the press to try and talk to the home crowd and the Tory party membership.
Jeremy Hunt at Tory party conference comparing the EU to the USSR, which sounds like something a Tim Pot student union debater would do. Got a lot of blowback from European diplomats, not least the former USSR countries that are now members of the EU, who I think pointed out that they are slightly different organisations.
Like the EU, for instance, does not actually enforce its rule via, you know, super secret police, gulags, anything like that. But hey-ho, if it reads good in the Daily Mail, that's all that matters.
At this summit this week, some progress was made, but apparently just basically in terms of a nicer tone. It sounds like May was nicer to the EU leaders. But there was meant to be a summit in mid-November, and that mid-November summit was meant to be the final point to have an agreement that could be signed off and then ratified in time for March. That summit's been cancelled because EU leaders don't think enough progress has been made. And part of it, I think, is probably because whatever solutions the civil servants come up with, it always seems like the government then undercuts. So on Sunday, I had a breaking news email from Politico saying that Britain and the EU were very close to making a deal. When I actually then read the email and looked on news websites to try and see if this was true, that deal had already been scuppered because Dominic Raab had flown out and said, no, it's not dead, it's a non-starter. And I know that Dominic Raab, part of his new role is Minister for No Deal, but I feel like he's interpreting it quite literally and narrowly, as in Minister to ensure no deal happens, rather than preparing us for no deal.
Again, the Conservatives seem to be approaching this completely backwards in a lot of ways. Ultimately, what this boils down to is the fact that Theresa May's first priority is not securing a Brexit deal of any sort, it's ensuring that she remains in power. every single action that Theresa May has taken on Brexit can be read purely as a, how do I maintain my grasp on my premiership? If you look at the recent events with that kind of view, it makes a lot more sense, because they need to keep those people on side, because if they don't, those letters go into the 1922 committee, and bang, Theresa May has to face a vote of no confidence, which she will probably lose at this point. Because now, even the likes of Nicky Morgan, Dominic Grieve, the more kind of sensible Tories, who are very much Remainers, are starting to make mutterings about this as well, because they know that it almost doesn't matter what the result is, there needs to be a result, and Theresa May just doesn't seem to be able to make a decision.
And again, I almost sound like Theresa May. I'm not going to comment on Conservative leadership speculations, but I still wonder if Theresa May would win an initial vote of confidence, if only because I think the same thing applies that we mentioned in the summer, and that is there's no obvious successor, and people really don't want it to be Boris Johnson.
And that right there is probably why no letters will actually go in, even given the current circumstances, but there's no guarantee on anything. Which means that nobody wants to risk being that final letter, which means this, as Johnny Mercer put it, this shit show continues on and on and on, and we have the same things happening time and time and time again, with no progress being made.
It would be hilarious if Graham Brady does have more than 48 letters, but he's put them in two or three different drawers and doesn't know how many he's got. Like, if we find that out in 20 years' time, that would just be genius. He kind of finds them. Oh, here's the 48.
Oh, I'm sorry, Nadine. I misplaced yours. I didn't realise. Oops.
But I think you're right in terms of Theresa May is not only trying to cling on to her position, she's also trying to keep her party united. And to be fair, after this week when she proposed an extension to the transition period, or as May wants to call it, the implementation period, her party was united, but it was united against her in horror and fury. There isn't enough time to do a proper trade deal. As we've said several times before on this podcast, the Canada deal took 7 years to negotiate. It needed 2 years to be ratified. It was nearly voted down because a Belgian regional parliament voted against it. And that was a run-of-the-mill trade deal, which is less complicated than Britain's Brexit deal. The other thing on top of that is this trade deal between Britain and the EU will be the only trade deal that is trying to bring two trading blocks further apart rather than closer together. So no one really knows what's going on. We're driving without a map at this point, as Ian Dunn has said. It's genuinely hard. You can't do it in the 2 years. You couldn't even do it in the 2 years in which the Article 50 negotiations are meant to take place. And you definitely can't do it in 2 years if the British government hadn't even started making preparations. An extension makes sense. And May came out and said, it's possible that we can extend the transition period by another year. And at the moment, I believe I'm right in saying the transition period goes up until the end of 2020?
I believe so, yes.
And so May was talking about it going to the end of 2021. Now, one of the reasons why the transition period was going to finish at the end of 2020, as I believe it is because that's the end of the EU budget cycle. And so if then Britain extends that transition period, it has to pay more contributions into the EU budget. If you remember the club, you've got to pay to use the club. Now, on May saying that they would extend the transition period, the Tory party went absolutely mad. And Ian Duncan Smith said that we don't want to pay the EU any more money. Jacob Rees-Mogg said, well, what would Margaret Thatcher do? I can't help but feeling that Margaret Thatcher would want to stay in the single market she created, but we'll park that. And Nick Bowles said, this is madness. We need to either join EFTA or EEA on an off-the-shelf medal and then work out what the hell we want to do. And then May backed down in a press conference. And she made things perfectly clear, Steve, because she said, I've always been very clear that we negotiated the implementation period and it would end in December 2020. An option to extend the implementation period has emerged, but we are not proposing an extension to the implementation period.
Which is basically a very roundabout way of saying, look, the EU thinks we need a bit more time to make this work because an extension has emerged, but we didn't propose it. Well, there's only two sides to this negotiation. So if we didn't propose it,
than the EU must have. Therefore, they think it's a good idea. They're trying to do us a favour by giving us a bit more time to work this out. But no, everything must be viewed through the Brexiteers' ridiculous glasses of paranoia. We're not going to do it.
Are glasses of paranoia the evil twin of the beer goggles?
Yes, and the long-lost love child of rose-tinted glasses.
As we said in the introduction, it's May's just basic lack of communication. I mean, Jacob Rees-Mogg mentioned Margaret Thatcher, and I suppose in one way, Margaret Thatcher was an effective communicator in that she was always very clear on what she was going to do and why she was going to do it and what the moral basis was behind that decision. And a lot of what she did was terrible, but she was very effective at communicating it.
And it was therefore very persuasive.
And May just cannot do that. She's not able or unwilling to talk about the trade-offs, not just between Irish borders and how much freedom do we want to negotiate trade deals, between how much access we want to the single market, but just basic trade-offs, as in, well, if you want this massive trade deal, then we need the time to negotiate it.
And I think ultimately what that boils down to is that Theresa May doesn't actually know what she wants. Like, one of the basic tenets of any form of communications, whether that be marketing or political comms or whatever, is you need to have your core message sorted. And that core message has to be based off of a simple thought of, what do you want to do? What are you trying to sell? And ultimately, to be able to answer that, you need to know what you're aiming for. And I don't think Theresa May knows that. And that's undermines any attempt at communication that they make, because it's very easy for them to go, oh, actually no, that's a good point. Oh no, that's gonna undermine my leadership. I shouldn't do that. And as a result, there are no red lines drawn, so you constantly end up backpedaling.
Or in fact, indeed, May set out very bold red lines very early on. She made those, but May made those red lines very, very early on, in that we won't be part of the customs union, we won't be part of the single market, we won't be part of anything with Europe in it, apart from the European Football Championships and the European Song Contest. And May's tried to backpedal. If May had tried to have this conversation at the height of her popularity, when she was 20 points ahead in the polls, she might well have had the political capital to have those difficult conversations.
Yeah, and
it's too late now.
Yeah, and ultimately, so much of the problems that Theresa May have comes down to the fact that she called a general election and lost it. She lost her majority. The very fact that she no longer has a majority means that so many different factions of her own party can scupper everything. And the fact that she lost her majority means she's reliant on the DUP. I don't doubt for a second that the European Reform Group would throw Northern Ireland to the wolves if they thought it would make it easier for them to actually get out of the EU. I think that if they weren't reliant on the DUP, they would happily set up a customs border, effectively in the middle of the Irish Sea between Northern Ireland and the UK, and we'd find a way to make it work, because it would make things so much quicker, so much easier, and it would basically solve the biggest issue that the EU has with our approach, which is the Irish border.
Shall I, with courtesy thanks to Ian Dunt, who has obviously driven himself mad trying to explain the inexplicable, but maybe now's a good time to try and dive into the details of the Irish border and what the problem is. And I know we've talked about it a couple of times, but I think it's worth restating. Last December, as you say, the Irish wicketkeeper issue was put up. And that basically says there's going to be an open border between the Republic of Ireland and Northern Ireland. And for there to be an open border, you need to make sure that there are no customs checks, so that everyone's paid the right amount of taxes on goods. And you're also meant to make sure that all the regulations are the same, so that you've got the same legal framework, so that everything coming through is legal. As part of that then, Northern Ireland was going to remain in the single market and the customs union until withdrawal agreement was, an agreement was negotiated in which the border was solved in some other form, whatever that is. Now, May's plan is basically still based on the Chequers deal we said earlier. Now, the point of Chequers is, it basically says, all right, the UK will join with the EU into a customs union for goods, but not services. Of course, the problem with the EU has with that is that the single market is indivisible. In other words, the single market has four freedoms, of goods, of services, of people and capital. And they have to be able to move without restriction throughout that single market. And so you can't start saying, well, we're going to have one without the other. It's not possible. That's what the EU said, and they've been very, very clear on that.
From day one.
From day one.
Literally written in pieces, written in reports, which have been available for anybody to read if you care to actually pay attention, which the government has not.
The solution that you talk about, Steve, if you have checks across the Irish Sea, the DUP have said that that is a red line. And Arlene Foster, using the diplomatic language she's well known for, has said that that's her blood red line, which is, I would go with an unfortunate phrasing given the history, but is that there's no border that divides Northern Ireland from the rest of the UK, because the DUP doesn't want any difference between Northern Ireland and the rest of the UK at all, apart from abortion legislation, obviously. But apart from that...
And equal marriage.
Equal marriage, yeah. Yes. But apart from that, exactly the same. And that scuppers the idea. Also, my favourite quote, though, from a DUP official, sadly anonymous this week. The DUP say they're going to squeeze their balls until their ears bleed. I can't remember whose balls they're referring to, if it's the Conservatives' balls or the EU's balls.
I'm also not sure they understand anatomy.
That's the problem, too. And it's the agreement with the DUP, which has been giving May its parliamentary majority. And one of the things, if we can kind of use that to talk about the politics of all this, is it feels like May is trying to kick the can down the road enough that the DUP actually do vote with the government to prop up the government on, say, things like the budget. Because there was a legislation this week, and I've completely forgotten what it was, but the DUP, basically a bill was pulled this week because the DUP refused to give their support to it. So if the DUP withdraw their support for the budget, that's confidence issue bad times, isn't it?
I mean, technically it's not a confidence issue because of a motion of confidence has now been codified in the Fixed Terms Parliament Act. But yeah, it would not be good times for the government because it would effectively mean they have lost their governing majority. Mm. And you would almost certainly have calls for a general election coming from Labour. The Tories, I don't think, would be dumb enough to actually vote for one at that point in time. But it would effectively confirm we would be 100% in a zombie government. And no progress could be made on anything.
Well, no, and one of the problems is, and we have mentioned this before, I genuinely don't know if there is a Commons majority for any particular form of Brexit.
Nope.
There's not the numbers yet for a people's vote. There's not the numbers yet for an EFTA EEA off-the-shelf option. There's no options yet to extend Article 50. There's not a majority, I don't think, for no deal. There's definitely not a majority for May's plan. So we're stuck. I mean, you've got a situation this week where you've had some Labour MPs like Gareth Snell, I think Ruth Smith, I think Caroline Flint have also been mentioned, saying that if it becomes to a choice between Theresa May's deal and no deal, then the responsible choice would be to vote with the government. But, I mean, I think it's a different question as to whether that is justifiable. But if there is a deal that some Labour MPs vote for, and we have talked about May trying to woo Labour MPs, I think it might attract a dozen, two dozen Labour MPs, but you probably lose three, four, five dozen Tory MPs who won't vote for that deal.
Yeah, essentially, they're, as you say, there's no way out of this puzzle based on the current parliamentary arithmetic. I do think we are going to get to a point where, sadly, another general election is inevitable, just because it's going to be the only way to break that deadlock, and it's got to be an election where Brexit is a central theme. Otherwise, you're just going to end up in a similar situation. You need to basically have somebody saying, running on one side of the issue, of either in Labour or the Tories, and saying, this is what we will do on Brexit. We will either go for hard Brexit, we will go for EEA membership, we will go for whatever, or we will hold another referendum. Whatever that might be, someone needs to make an explicit statement so that you can actually have a full debate about what that looks like, so people can then go into the voting booths and say, right, I am voting, and Brexit is a massive part of that. Because the problem with 2017 was, as much as everyone thought it was going to be a Brexit election, it wasn't. No one could actually lay claim to basically saying, hey, this is pro or against Brexit, because Labour weren't pro-Brexit necessarily. They didn't really mention it, but they weren't against it in the official manifesto necessarily. They were just against the Tory Brexit. And the Tories are obviously pro-Brexit, but only a certain type of Brexit under Theresa May. And it just leads to a massive mess, which we probably do need a general election to sort out.
But haven't you just described basically why actually a people's vote might be preferable? Because then it's an election on that particular issue.
But you can't get there's not the majority to get through a people's vote.
But I wonder, though, one of the reasons there can't be a general election is because Tory MPs are genuinely scared about a Corbyn government.
Yep.
Because they think it will lead to Venezuela and we all eat zoo animals or something. Now, I think it's more likely that Tory MPs vote, or enough Tory MPs with whoever else votes for it, vote for another referendum, or at least another vote on the deal, than our vote to trigger a new election.
Okay, that is probably more likely. The issue, however, though, is you then need either the Tory leadership or the Labour leadership to actually push that as their policy. And neither side are looking like they want to do that at the moment. Theresa May just won't, because the minute she tries to do that, that is, she's done. Like, all of the letters will go in at that point. It doesn't matter who it is that takes over, the ERG just won't care. All of the letters will go in. For Labour, if the minute they actually, they need, if they were to try and do that and lead on that, yeah, it would make more sense for them. But it then, the balancing act that Jeremy Corbyn's been playing over Brexit suddenly tips very violently in another direction. It is very, very difficult to turn around and say, I back a second referendum where I back a second referendum. In
some meant to call it people's vote now, Steve.
No. It's very difficult to say, I back a second referendum, and it not be seen in some form as being anti-Brexit. And it also, the most likely form of a people's vote or second referendum, whatever you want to call it, getting through is probably on a no-deal government deal basis, rather than it being a no-deal government deal, let's go back to rejoin the EU or something else basis. Because, well, one, if you have too many options, God only knows what happens. You could end up in a weird situation where potentially more people actually preferred to stay in the EU as their first preference, but we still end up going out on a hard Brexit because of the weird ways that you could rank the options.
Mm.
And for Labour, there's just too much to lose. So, like, if they lose the small towns which voted Brexit because they start backing a vote, they're in trouble, and they're not going to be able to make the gains they need off of the Tories at the next general election. If they go for a people's vote, but one that's, you know, half-hearted, the government's deal or no deal, well, guess what? You're just going to annoy and piss off 90% of the Labour membership, who are ardently, strongly pro-Remain and pro-European. So, like, I've mentioned before that if there was any issue that Jeremy Corbyn could have his betrayal moment over, it is the EU, because he is not a pro-EU politician. He has never been a pro-EU politician. He is very Benite in that mould. As a result of that, his instincts are completely opposite to a lot of his supporters. Now, he's been able to get away with it so far because his instincts are so aligned in other ways that he's got a lot of political capital to burn. But if there's one issue where he can burn through it all, it's going to be the EU. Doesn't matter how much Aaron Bastani or Owen Jones cheerlead about it or talk about it, the fact is, just look at the reaction that Keir Starmer got for his speech at Labour conference. Standing ovation for just saying something vaguely pro-European.
I managed to forget that Aaron Bastani existed, and now you've managed to remind me, and I feel sad now. My impression with Corbyn's Brexit policy is, at the moment, it's not like he's as hostile to the EU as Tony Benn is. I think Jeremy Corbyn's Brexit position is whatever position will win him the next election. I think Keir Starmer's Brexit position has been a little bit similar to the Wilson Crab Walk in the early to mid-1970s, which has basically been to try and shift the Labour Party 2 inches more pro-Remain than the Tories all the way along. And I think where Starmer wants to go to, as from the speech you've highlighted, is some form of people's vote type scenario. Brexit's only going to be a bigger issue in the news, and the problems and the disasters involved with a hard Brexit and a no-deal Brexit are only going to become more apparent in the news. I mean, the populist polls this week have usually seen about 25-30% of the public noticing Brexit as a story. That's gone up to 46% this week, which is a massive high. So I think more and more people are paying attention and realising it's going disastrously. And a lot of the other general opinion polling shows that A, Labour isn't really pulling ahead of the Tories, but that's mainly because of a softening support amongst Remainers. And B, that people don't think Brexit's going well, and there's a small, consistent lead for Remain in a lot of those opinion polls. And a small but consistent lead saying they think that leaving the EU is the wrong decision. And that polling evidence, I think, only hardens as we go forward. And so I think electorally, there's probably an argument for Corbyn to shift position, not only with his momentum base, with Labour membership, but also generally as well. And I think you're right. I think a lot, and you look at the Labour MPs like Caroline Flint, like Ruth Smith, like Gareth Snell, they are in the kind of towns you're talking about. They are the areas that voted for Brexit quite heavily. But there is some polling that suggests that attitudes are changing in those constituencies. And I can see it almost getting there, but I think a lot of it depends on the next few months.
Yeah, I mean, if you were hoping from this podcast for us to tell you what's going to happen, tough luck. We can't do that because everything is just so up in the air at the moment. I mean, the fact that nothing has changed really since the last time we talked about it means that everything's still to play for in one way or another. And in some ways, that's terrifying because we don't know where we're going. And we're now getting to the point where businesses are actually going to start looking at their plans and going, hey, if we knew what it was, whether it was a hard Brexit, a soft Brexit, EEA membership, just customs union membership, single market membership, whatever, if we knew what it was, we can plan for it. It's the fact that we don't know what we get, what's actually the end state is, mm-hmm. or what we're even potentially moving towards. That's what's actually going to damage us more than anything else as a country and our economy. And that's entirely down to Theresa May.
Yeah. Well, that seems like a decent way, an indecent way maybe, in which to end our podcast. If you are interested and want to find more episodes, you can find us on iTunes, on Acast, or wherever else you get your podcasts. We've also got a website, which is notenoughchampagne.com, and our Facebook page is facebook.com/notenoughchampagne. Our Twitter handle is @nochampagnepod. My Twitter handle is @paperbackrioter.
Mine is @acousticradical.
James Crown designed our logo, and Dave Depp is responsible for our theme tune, Plucky Goat for Times. Happy plotting, everyone.